John, we have to go now. Those were some of the first words that Pam shouted at the stranger she found on the mountain. She didn't normally talk this way to people, but the situation was life or death. Pam was an expert hiker. She made her way up one of her favorite trails near Mount Washington. She didn't always complete her hikes. It wasn't necessarily about the destination. But even if it had been, the erratic weather around Mount Washington could turn deadly in a matter of moments. Pam had her exit strategy thoroughly planned that day. She encountered the stranger on the mountain. The weather was getting really bad, and she should have already turned around. But the footprints in front of her were those of sneakers. It was a sign that someone was ill-prepared for the journey. And they were fresh, so Pam pressed ahead. She saw the man shortly after. He was sitting motionless, wearing shorts and a windbreaker, staring into the white winter storm ahead of him. Pam called out to the man, but he said nothing in return. He showed some signs of movement, but he didn't respond to any of her questions. It was time to move into rescue mode. So she gave the man the name John and started retrieving what was available to keep him warm. It took her about an hour to get his limbs moving again and to get him to speak. By that time, they had to get moving or they would both die. John, we have to go now. You're going to have to stay right on me, she said. She knew that she had to be forceful. He was moments away from stopping on the path and falling asleep. At one point, he curled down to the snow and said that she should go on without him. She said, that's not an option, John. We still have the toughest part to go. So get up, suck it up, and keep going. After hours of fighting to get back, Pam and John finally made it to their cars alive. Her forceful message and continual push saved a life on the brink. Warning messages aren't comfortable to receive, and they are not pleasant to give either. But no one questions the choice of this woman to be forceful with her words, to get the attention of a man in a dangerous funk in this incredible true story. We face all sorts of threats in our spiritual lives as well, many of which we have explored in depth as we have considered the words of James. In our passage for today, James uses some of the most forceful language towards those who hoard wealth in poor surroundings. As with the man caught in the storm on the mountain trail, James feared that some of these people might be too far gone. Without some forceful words, James would lose his chance to save their lives. This message may not be comfortable for those of us living in a time and a place where we enjoy so much. But wealth has the potential of lulling us to sleep on the trail. How can we wisely navigate this last dangerous wave? Read James chapter 4, verses 13 through chapter 5, verse 6. At first glance, the end of chapter 4 may not appear to have anything to do with wealth. But how might verse 17 suggest otherwise? Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this city or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. If anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. Now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth is rotted, and the moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you. Many believe that James is addressing two different groups of people in chapter 4, verse 13 through 17, and 5, verses 1 through 6. Some speculate that the first group was a class of merchants who might be considered the middle class of their day. James's description of people moving to one place or another to buy and trade fits the description as well. The second group in chapter 5 may have been the wealthiest group of all, landowners. The tone shifts significantly in this portion, and James gives this group the label, the rich. Let's begin with the merchants in chapter 4. Some have read the last verse of chapter 4 as an independent proverb stating, if anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. But the verse begins with an important so or therefore, not translated by the NIV. This connects it to the previous section and frames it in the whole discussion on wealth. Although the end of chapter 4 appears only to be about making plans without the Lord, this verse suggests that this group is doing something worse. They were neglecting their responsibility to do good, which James calls a sin. It's possible that this group was relying on their business plans and prospects as an excuse for why they weren't helping the poor person in their midst. One of them might have said, I know Chuck and his family are really hurting right now, but I have to save up for this big business venture we have planned for a couple years away. We'll surely make a great profit and have something to share with Chuck and his family when we return. James didn't question their generosity, but he did challenge their timing. Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. James continues, instead you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. It was common for Christians to use the expression, if it is God's will, regarding their plans. The Apostle Paul told the churches at Ephesus, Romans, and Corinthians that he desired and planned to visit them again if it is God's will. But Paul didn't wait for God to reveal it to him. He made a plan and acknowledged that the Lord might have something different for him. That simple acknowledgement that God could do something different than we expect can help us respond appropriately to disappointment. But even more importantly, it can give us a new outlook on the present. You may have been saving for something for some time when you hear that a poor family needs a car. Could this be the good that God has put in your path to do? Perhaps you have some business venture you have been preparing for. Maybe your savings, well invested, could buy a similar family 2 vehicles with extra left given more time. But James would remind us that we don't know the future. In the end, death plays no favorites. If we miss the good we know we ought to do right in front of us, James says that inaction is sin. In the first section, James gives the merchants counsel on what to do with their wealth and plans for more. That's a good thing. If James is giving them advice, he believes there is still hope for a turn. The next group he addresses in chapter 5, whom some think are wealthy landowners, don't get any advice. They only get a warning. Weep and wail because of the misery coming upon you, James says. The corrosion of your gold and silver and the destruction of your clothes are signs of the same thing that will happen to you, he continues. These wealthy people weren't just wealthy. They were denying their poor workers the wages they promised. James says that they have condemned the innocent, which may suggest they were charging the poor in court as well. James's reference to the last days and the day of slaughter make it clear that judgment is coming for these people, and the outlook is not favorable. One of the big questions of this letter has to do with James's view of this group of people. Are they Christians or are they not? In James chapter 1, verses 9 through 11, he clearly calls the poor brothers, but not the rich in what follows. In James 2, verses 7, he separates the rich and says that they were bringing Christians to court and blaspheming the name of Jesus. Here James addresses them directly, so it's likely that at least a few of them were in the community. But the way he talks about their destiny raises some difficult questions. James could have easily had in mind the story his brother Jesus told about the rich man who died and was judged that we considered in an earlier session. The spirit of Abraham said to that man, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. Lazarus was the beggar that sat at this rich man's gate asking for any scrap that might fall from his table. Now, in an ironic reversal, the rich man was begging the spirit of Abraham to send Lazarus to give him just a taste of the cool water he had. Jesus promised in Matthew 5:3 that the kingdom of heaven would be given to the poor in spirit, a phrase that didn't just include the materially poor, but perhaps those who held on to all of their possessions with an open hand. But Luke records Jesus as simply saying, "Blessed are you who are poor," without qualifying it. It's the literal, material poor whom Jesus pegs as the recipients of great blessings. Is God showing favoritism to the poor? Leviticus 19:15, which we also considered in another session, says, "Do not pervert justice, do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great." That verse has to do with justice at the courts, but the principle could easily extend to other areas of life. God is not showing favoritism to the poor. He is simply making a point about how hard it is for people that are wealthy to inherit God's kingdom. In Matthew 19:23, Jesus said to his disciples, "Truly I tell you, it is hard for someone who is rich to enter into the kingdom of heaven. Again, I tell you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of God." Matthew records that the disciples were astonished. Jesus tells them it is possible for a rich man to be saved because all things are possible with God, but it's not easy. If it were easy, Jesus wouldn't have said anything at all. Wealth always runs the risk of becoming one's master, Jesus warned in another place. And God doesn't like to share that position. This is probably where these tough words come into play. For the few wealthy readers who were listening to his letter, James needed to take the one opportunity he had to wake them up. They were becoming slaves to their money, like the ill-prepared hiker who got caught in the storm and wanted to stop and rest on the way out, even at times telling his rescuer to go on without him. These rich people had settled into the security that came from their wealth. They were in danger of being lulled into complacency, of becoming satisfied with earthly treasures alone, and of overlooking the value of the people around them in need. This happens when we make our wealth our primary pursuit. It's why suicide rates commonly increase during times of economic downturn. Some wealthy people simply cannot envision their life without their wealth and everything that's associated with it. It becomes life itself. People become a means to an end, and a life beyond this one turns into a passing thought. There's some evidence that the expression "cut and run" came about when sailors needed to make a quick getaway. Some have speculated that sailors actually cut the ropes to their anchors in order to make their escape. It's an appropriate response if we find ourselves pursuing wealth to the extent that it is becoming a master. The pursuit of money can be a trap that is simply too dangerous because it's difficult to see that you're in it. Chances are this topic hits close to home for some of you. Let me make a few important clarifications. James is not teaching against capitalism or looking for opportunities to make a profit. Proverbs 21:5 says, "The plans of the diligent lead to profit as surely as haste leads to poverty." He warns us against being so future-oriented with spending plans that we neglect the real needs around us. Nor is James teaching against savings and investment. Proverbs 21:20 says, "The wise store up choice food and olive oil, but fools gulp theirs down." And James would never encourage careless giving to the poor. The Apostle Paul gave instructions to the church at Thessalonica, "The one who is unwilling to work shall not eat." And James is not teaching that it's wrong to have money. No other gospel stresses the dangers of wealth and the value of giving more than the Gospel of Luke. Jesus asked to stay with a rich tax collector by the name of Zacchaeus in Luke 19. Upon his visit, Zacchaeus announced to Jesus, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anyone out of anything, I will give back four times the amount." Giving up half of his possessions is a lot. So is paying quadruple for his misdeeds. But he didn't give up all of his wealth. You'd think Jesus would have scolded him. "Only half, Zacchaeus?" But instead, Jesus responded by saying, "Today, salvation has come to this house." But James is clear, living lavishly when fellow Christians in our circles are unable to meet basic needs is living dangerously close to the wrong side of judgment. That's especially the case in what James and other Christian writers call the last days, the time between Jesus' first coming and his return. The time to accept God's message along with its transforming power is quickly coming to a close. And if we aren't careful to cut that extra weight that is holding us down, it will slowly become our master. We may not even know that it's happened until it's too late. Now it's your turn. At the very beginning of the letter to James, there are three verses that deal with this theme from another angle. Read James chapter 1, verses 9 through 11, and come to your group prepared with answers to the following questions. Why do you think James believes Christians in lowly circumstances should boast in their high position? Explain. Do you think the rich person James has in mind is a Christian? Look at these verses carefully and consider James chapter 2, verses 5 through 7, and 4 verses 13 through 5, 6 as well. How does your answer from the previous question determine what it means for the rich to fade away even while they go about their business in James chapter 1, verse 11?